The European Union has not treated us well.
Stupid European elites jumping off the cliffs once again.
Yes, you are the guilty people, and you refuse to accept it.
This is EU Scream, the podcast on Europe and its political extremes. I'm James, a journalist who's crisscrossed Europe for 15 years now, covering politics and the economy.
I'm Joanna. I'm sitting in this week for Tom. I'm a lifelong feminist with over 20 years' experience leading European campaign groups.
In this episode, Corinna Horst of the German Marshall Fund says a project making women more prominent in EU policymaking is looking to expand. We also hear from Jeanne Ponte at the European Parliament on why some of the lawmakers resisting sexual harassment training might benefit from it the most. First, Joanna Maycock of the European Women's Lobby on the far right's agenda for women, the decades-long struggle for equal pay, and yodeling. So, Joanna, a warm welcome to EU Scream.
Thank you very much, James. Very pleased to be here.
You're kind of an old hand when it comes to podcasts, right? You've been on some pretty big ones.
Yeah, I was on last year, I was on the Guilty Feminist podcast, which is one of the biggest feminist podcasts globally. Generally, it's a kind of comedy, feminist comedy podcast, but it's quite hard to get much comedy out of Brexit and women's rights, to be honest.
And how did that go?
Really great. There were, I would say, around 3,000 people in the audience because it was recorded live at the Barbican.
The Barbican in London.
In London.
That's a major concert hall.
Yeah. Completely sold out. And I would say the vast majority of the audience were women between the ages of 25 and 35. It's really great to see that new generation of women, of activists, really claiming the space and thinking about feminism and activism anew.
Terrific. Okay, I want to play you a video from a group that calls themselves Yogita.
We are in the Alps and there's yodeling going on.
How did you like Yogita?
To me, from what I could tell, very much in the tradition of feminist satire against some of the far right claims of particularly they're talking about yodeling, and they on the video, obviously, they're wearing kind of almost traditional, like,
there's
mountain
like a dirndl.
Gear. Yeah, there's a dirndl going on.
And a bandolier.
Yes, exactly. We have, you know, as feminists, we have, like, a reputation of having no humour at all. But actually, a lot of feminist activism throughout history, really, has been a lot based on humour and satire.
These two women, Gaia and Elenos, make noises against the Nazis, right? Their name echoes and mocks Pegida, which I always have to have my notes for this, because it stands for the Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the Occident, which is, of course, a German nationalist, anti-Islam, far-right movement with these tiny offshoots in a number of other countries. And Yogita is kind of part of a fight back, right, against Pegida. They're trying to drown out these voices of hate with noises of their own and reclaiming a kind of arch-conservative art form, right? You know, yodeling. This is a pair of hilarious women in Germany raising their voices against the far right in the modern era. You know, what is the far right's narrative about women?
Great question. And how can yodeling be deployed to drown it out? I mean, as part of the broader trend towards far-right, populist, anti-migration, nationalist parties and movements in Europe, we've always been aware, as the European Women's Lobby and our members, that that comes with a deeply misogynistic agenda. Why? Their narrative and their values are very linked up with tradition and conservatism. So it's all about looking backwards. And that, of course, includes a very conservative and traditional role for women. And very practically what that's meant is that, for example, organisations supporting and promoting women's rights have been closed down, defunded, removed from advisory bodies to governments.
In particular countries, this has been...
In many countries, and increasingly so, and sometimes certainly in Hungary and Poland. And actually, we've also seen not just women's organisations being removed from advisory bodies, but being replaced by organisations who promote large families. But I wanted to say also that it's not only in Eastern Europe. These narratives are also part of far-right populist, what we call anti-feminist movements in Western Europe. Certainly when it comes to the Andalusia, the shock of the success of the Andalusian sort of far-right parties.
They're called Vox.
Vox,
and
yeah.
They did better than expected in some recent elections in Andalusia in southern Spain.
Exactly right. And their primary demand is on rolling back some of the gender equality legislation in Spain. That's their primary thing they want to attack, including the efforts that have happened in Spain to really address violence against women, change the laws on rape after the Wolfpack case in Spain, where there was a gang rape of a young girl in one of the bull running events where the perpetrators went free as a result of the law in Spain. And so there have been attempts to change the law. And this party, Vox, has been making that one of its targets. They don't want the law to change. So it's very interesting that we are both, a lot of these parties and movements have a very traditional view of women and women's role. And at the same time, they seem to be supporting measures that enable violence against women to continue. Now, can I get on with the quiz?
Oh, God.
Right, so I've got some little questions for you. We had a little discussion in the office. We've had some fun putting together the multiple choice questions for you, James.
Thank you.
So, the first one. How many countries in the European Union have 50% of women or more in their national parliaments? Is it A, 5, B, 3, or C, 0?
How many parliaments in the European Union, that's the EU28, mm-hmm. have 50% or more women in their legislatures? Mm-hmm. Not counting the UK House of Lords, where it's definitely pretty minimal. I'd say I'm going to go for 0.
You're absolutely right.
Yes.
Spot on. So no parliament in the European Union, no national parliament has ever achieved 50%. There are only a couple in the world who ever have. Only 11 national parliaments out of the 28 have less than 2/3 of men. Only 11 have 1/3 women or more. Less than 50% just ain't good enough, as far as we're concerned. At the top of the tables are sort of Sweden and Finland, but also other countries that have introduced quotas, actually, like Belgium and Spain, actually, which recently had, as for the first time ever in Europe, got a cabinet of ministers, which is more than 50% women.
Fascinating.
But we are a long way off. European Parliament elections coming up. Opportunity to increase the number of women in the European Parliament, we hope.
And what are roughly the statistics there?
At the time of the last election, 37% of the European Parliament, members of the European Parliament were women. It's actually gone down to about 35% during the legislature. So women have dropped out, men have replaced them. That means there are 200 more men MEPs than women. Second question, how many women in the European Union have experienced sexual harassment at least once in their lives? Is it A, 55%, B, 40%, or C, 10%?
And was this from a recent survey or
from
survey data, Eurobarometer or something like that?
It was survey data collected by the Fundamental Rights Agency in 2014.
That's what is the Fundamental Rights Agency?
Oh, it's the official European Union agency that looks at issues to do with human rights. You know, inside the European Union, we call them fundamental rights.
So again, the percentages were?
A, 55, B, 40, or C, 10%.
I'm going to go for 40.
It's A, 55%.
Gosh.
I would actually guess if they did the survey today, the number would be higher.
Higher than 55?
Yeah, because I think subsequent to Me Too, I think the public conversation about sexual harassment is such that I think people have a higher awareness of what constitutes sexual harassment. So I wouldn't be surprised if they did the survey today, more people would identify as having experienced sexual harassment.
Complicated question, but what is the threshold for harassment?
Okay, so there's EU legislation on sexual harassment. So it's any unwanted sexual it's not only sexual physical contact, but it can be verbal, sexual, innuendo, anything that's unwanted, sort of unwanted behavior of a sexual nature.
And that unwanted behavior language, it's where do we find that? Or is that a customary definition?
No, that's a EU directive. And that's been transposed into national laws as well across the European Union. So the third question, what year did the EU commit to equal pay for work of equal value? Was it A, 1957, so the beginning of the EU, B, 1975, or C, 2009, Treaty of Lisbon?
I mean, I can't imagine that a Christian Democrat dominated Europe, which it was for so much of the period up to the late 2000s, and then beyond it, actually.
Forever.
Forever. I'm going to go for 2009.
1957.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. My cynicism is completely...
It's astonishing. And so very important for everybody listening to know that we have been striving for equal pay for work of equal value. It's a very far-reaching commitment, actually. Most countries have some kind of commitment today to equal pay, but not to work of equal value. But it's in the Treaty of Rome, actually, right at the outset of the EU, and makes it even more galling that we're so far from having achieved it still. It's quite cool. It actually relates to the level playing field between the original six members of the common market. It was to do with the pay of textile workers who were, I think, male in France and female in the Netherlands, and they didn't want to be undercut.
That competition law is feminist?
Absolutely. And if you imagine who was signing the Treaty of Rome, there was literally no women in the room, I don't think. So it's quite
Hats
interesting.
And
yeah. It's really, really quite interesting. And it's something we come back to again and again because it's such a part of the founding principles of the EU that more action is needed at EU level really to combat. We still have a 16% pay gap. In Germany and the UK, it's more like 20% because of part-time work, because of lower pay overall, because of higher levels of unemployment for women, etc. That actually, and the pension gap, I think it masks actually a much greater impoverishment of women over their lifetime.
Corinna Horst is the Deputy Director of the Brussels Office of the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a leading think tank for transatlantic debate and analysis. GMF, as the think tank more commonly is known, has supported democracy and the rule of law in Europe for decades. There's now a renewed sense of urgency about preserving those achievements as fractures within European countries and among them grow deeper. Corinna says such divisive times cry out for a female leader of Angela Merkel's stature and skills to take the helm of the European Union. It remains a matter of fevered speculation whether the German chancellor will continue to make history by taking one of the union's two top jobs never held by a woman. Corinna already has helped to tip the Brussels power game a bit more in women's favor. She is a co-founder of the Brussels Binder, a kind of yellow pages for female experts. It's a refreshingly concrete push for equality in a city where much policymaking remains male-dominated and where chauvinism, particularly among some German conservative lawmakers, still runs deep. I first asked Corinna for more about how the Brussels Binder works.
So the Brussels Binder is a publicly available database of female policy experts, so that when events organizers are looking for speakers or journalists are looking for people to provide analysis and quotes, they can turn to people they might not have thought of, because there's a natural tendency if you're doing an event or you're writing an article, you go to the people and institutions that you know to ask for feedback, input, and advice.
Maybe people who don't live in a policy town don't really know what doing an event means. This is just what runs Washington and Brussels. People constantly putting on conferences, putting on panels, dinners, speakers, and so on and so forth.
You know, it actually goes even a bit further. I mean, it is about infusing ideas into the process of making policy. So me, myself working in a think tank, you know, we would like to provide policy analysis, but also policy recommendations. Now, some of us have sort of realized that, and I'm actually not just talking about my own think tank, but others that are around town, because the Brussels Binder by now is sort of endorsed and supported by 18 think tanks, that we tend to have oftentimes people on panels that sort of think alike, that there wasn't really a lot of controversy, and, you know, and oftentimes these people knew each other. I mean, of course it is about making women more visible and audible and showing that they have expertise, and it is about gender equality. But beyond that, it's actually more about innovative new ideas and perspectives that we want to bring forward. You know, everybody talks about Europe being in a crisis, transatlantic relations being in a crisis. Well, we need new ideas how to fix it.
Are there any sort of measurable metrics that you can point to?
Yes, we will pay attention, and we are paying attention to the evaluation aspect, so we can also then highlight the successes that we have. At the moment, it's anecdotal. It's, you know, women who tell us that they have been contacted through the Brussels Binder and have been given opportunities to speak, and vice versa, also events organizers who said, you know, we've used this, this has been terrific because we were able to bring new voices on it. But it's anecdotal at the moment.
And you mentioned 18 think tanks. Mm-hmm. Is there a 19th and a 20th who should come on board?
Well, one of the things we are planning to do, thanks to a grant from the European Commission, is we want to take the story and experience of the Brussels Binder and bring it to Europe, to the, and the other EU member states, but also to connect with existing initiatives that are already out there, but who might, at the moment, you know, operate on a purely national level. And sort of, you know, we want to connect. And there's another angle to it, and it's, you know, we still need to find ways to empower women that they feel they can get into the binder, that they know enough about the policy areas, and they feel comfortable speaking in public, speaking to the media, moderating. Because there is a bit of a tendency that women continue to sort of say, oh, I don't know enough. So we sort of need to work on that.
So a woman has never been president of the ECB, the commissioner of the council, and only two have been in the history of the parliament, Simone
Veil
and Nicole Fontaine. And now a record number of top EU positions are becoming vacant at once, including ECB, including EEAS, which of course is the foreign policy arm of the EU, and NATO. So my question is, time for quotas?
I mean, personally, I like quotas. I don't think I would go about it that way for these positions. However, I hope the momentum will pick up, that there is a strong demand from various sides to fill one or two of these positions with women. And not traditionally, again, the foreign policy position, because it's actually the weakest one in the whole link. But
and we've had Catherine Ashton and Federica Mogherini. So it's about time that...
I think it would be time for having a man have that position for change, just to make, just to mix things up a bit. I would love to see the position of the president of the council or the president of the European Commission to be a woman. Now, I think for the Commission it's less likely because we're a bit bound to this very awkward, bizarre Spitzenkandidaten process or lead candidate process, but with...
This process that is governed in some ways by the political party,
exactly,
political group that gets the most votes in the May elections.
Exactly, and they tend to be still gatekeepers and very male-dominated, and half of them haven't opened up to mixed ballots, so one man, one woman, and
right,
the parliamentarians.
They have not opened.
They have not.
What is a mixed ballot?
So you have that with some of the Social Democrats, and you have it with the Green parties, that they put pressure on, or sometimes it's even legally binding, that they have their political parties provide candidates, so one man, one woman, one man, one woman, so to assure a bit of more diversity in the candidates that...
And does that, by definition, assure 50-50, or is it more of a list system that...
I mean, again, I don't think we need to push for the numbers. It's you know, it's sending a message, it's raising awareness, it's showcasing that there's talent out there, and create awareness that if you have a diverse group of people working on a political file, that they actually might have an opportunity, even better opportunity, to get it through.
Right, right. Now, some of the names that are out there of women who could make it to the top of the EU institutions include Angela Merkel, Margrethe Vestager, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, although those are two Danes in that category. And any preferences or any, you know, it's early days, but any runners and riders?
I think it's way too early to talk about names, because history has also shown if you put out your name too early, you get eliminated very soon. It is maybe more to look for the qualities that we are looking in these candidates to take up these positions. And given that we are experiencing a Europe that is very fractured with internal divisions that actually make it very hard for the institutions to operate, we are in desperate need for particular leadership skills that create some sort of cohesion that traditionally are associated with women, that I think are very, well, very much needed at the moment. And Angela Merkel in some ways has embodied them. Now, I don't think she is going to run for it. I think she wants to break. But, you know, it's listening. It's picking up your interlocutor. It's giving him or her the sense that you're taking their concerns sort of seriously, that you're looking for a compromise. I mean, this is what Europe is about. But at the same time, also being excellent in your portfolios and speaking with a strong, authentic voice. I think such a person could do as well.
So, when it comes to the Brussels bubble, what would you say are the kind of everyday examples of sexism that women encounter here and that you have personally encountered?
You know, the classic thing that you hear, you sit around the table, you make a comment, nobody picks up on it. A few minutes later, a guy says the same thing and everybody thinks it's the best idea. You know, there are environments where men mostly immediately associate a young woman with being the secretary or the intern who is just good enough to bring coffee and tea but not have an opinion. It is, you know, experiences women not being promoted because they get the feedback in their performance review meetings, it's too early and aren't you about to have, you know, you get into this age when you should have children, so you don't really have time to work on your career. There's age discrimination that, you know, you're too young, you haven't been around for a while, so you don't know what you're talking about. To a lot of encounters that haven't happened in the evening at receptions or dinners where alcohol is in play and, you know.
Are you saying that sometimes a woman might be very wary of that environment and thus not make the kind of collegial bonding that others do?
I think for women it is tricky to attend those things. Now, if you go in and you see this as a, you know, it's a professional opportunity, this is where I can develop myself intellectually or because I want to build up on my networks, you know this, you go in and you hold your guard. It can be a very productive environment and, you know, if you go there with a bit of, yeah, I mean, sort of strength as well as sort of a bit of a sense of humor and, you know, charm, you can also play it and, yeah, in some ways use it to your benefit. You just need to know where the red lines are. Now, interestingly enough, I've recently heard also from two guys that they have been inappropriately or have been approached by women in a way that made them feel rather uncomfortable. So it's, yeah, it can go both ways. And old, young, men, women. It's a power game in this town, and you kind of need to know how to play along with it.
If I may, I would add one more element to what you were talking about, and that's impunity. I don't mean to single anybody out, but you could think of Günther Oettinger, who I think he once labeled female celebrities as stupid for having naked photographs of them that were hacked and stolen. And this did not impede Mr. Oettinger's ability to join the European Commission, and he's made further gaffes, you know, racism, and some other remarks. He's now in charge of talent management policy at the European Commission, and making sure that women represent 40% of the commission's senior and middle management by the end of 2019. What kind of signal does that send?
While I don't condone this kind of comments and behavior, you know, we're all part of our history and our context. We adapt. And so I'm not sure I would put too much emphasis on this. You know, I think people also deserve a second chance. Now, he is in charge of this particular policy, but he's not doing it on himself. He has a whole team around it. The whole institution has woken up to this sees a need for it. Something was given to him also means he needs to adapt and change, and I think he has. I've heard from women who work with him, who have interacted with him, that, you know, he's adapted different language. And so I think that's a good sign, because we can't change society. It's just the women adapt, but it's also the men adapting.
You know, there was an even more extreme case. This guy called Janusz Korwin-Mikke, who is a member of the European Parliament from Poland, and he has extremely eccentric views. He said in March 2017 that, of course, women must earn less than men because they are weaker, they are smaller, and they are less intelligent. They must earn less, that's all. But then last year, the European Court of Justice overturned the relatively minor sanction that was levied against him anyway. You know, I look at that and I think impunity in a way.
Yes. Now, this guy faced huge rebuttal and criticism on social media. Openly, female parliamentarians coming forward and saying this was a very stupid thing to say.
And of course, women must earn less than men because they are weaker, they are smaller, they are less intelligent, and they must earn less. That's all.
You're concerned how we women can represent citizens on an equal footing with you. Now I think I need to defend European women from people like you.
You know, anything related to the European Parliament, I take with sort of a grain of salt or with caution. It's a highly politicized body. I don't envy anybody working inside there. And a lot of what happens is, at the end of the day, parliamentarians protecting each other. And so I think a whole lot more needs to happen to get this institution to pay attention to appropriate behavior, really putting strict regulation down that are then being followed. And I don't see that we're there yet.
The modish buildings adorned with banners and slogans celebrating tolerance and equality can make the European quarter of Brussels feel like a kind of civil rights nirvana. The truth is more complicated. There is a critical lack of racial diversity in the institutions that run the European Union, and sexual harassment is a concern. Even before the Me Too movement exploded onto the global agenda, Jeanne Ponté, a young assistant at the European Parliament, was keeping a notebook documenting the harassment she and her peers were experiencing. After Jeanne talked about her notebook on French regional radio, her story was picked up by French national media.
Que peut faire le Parlement européen? On en parle avec vous, Jeanne Ponté. Vous êtes assistante parlementaire. Vous êtes le...
And then internationally.
La asesora parlamentaria francesa Jeanne Pont mostró una pequeña libreta.
She now speaks for the Me Too EP movement at the European Parliament. Me Too EP is challenging all candidates running in May's EU elections to pledge to take an anti-harassment course and support other reforms if elected. I first asked Jeanne how it all began.
I was just arriving at the European Parliament as the parliamentary assistant. I was 23 years old, so really young, working in a most manly committee, which is industry, research and energy. So you don't have so many women there. And I did remember, like, in like a networking event organized by the electronic industry, seeing this old man looking at me and just like following me in the event. And I feel really like uncomfortable because you feel uncomfortable. You're at your workplace and you see someone like really looking at you intensively as a piece of meat and following you. So you're not able to do your work. And so I started developing this avoidance strategy when you avoid someone. And when we wanted to leave this event, I saw him at the exit door. So I don't know if he was waiting for me, but he was there at the exit door. So I necessarily had to walk in front of him. And while I was walking, he just like put his arm on my chest, blocking my way, my exit to this event, and asking me like really awkwardly, "It's the first time I notice you. You're new here, right? And are you a parliamentary assistant? Are you a journalist? Would you like to go for a drink with me after work?" And I left the event, and during like two seconds, not more, I asked myself, but did I do something wrong? Did I let him imagine something? Maybe I was not wearing the appropriate clothes for work. And I felt so bad of myself just to think that, because I'm a feminist. I did not discover women's rights arriving at the European Parliament. But I also told myself, oh my God, if I'm able to ask myself during 3 seconds those questions, let's imagine for the rest of the humanity, it will be exactly the same. So in order to not get used and to not find any justification, I need to start writing. And this is like how the notebook started. For me, it was quite an easy idea because I always have notebooks in my purse. Either I wrote about books I like or movies I want to see. So I also figured out having another notebook about sexism will be a good solution.
You don't give the identity of the people who are the harassers, but may I ask you what language this person at that first industry committee meeting was speaking to you?
The first one was a German conservative MEP, and it does not surprise me as well, because last week we were struggling a lot in order to make adopted one big famous amendment about making the training, respect and dignity at work mandatory for the members of the European Parliament. And the big resistances came from the German conservative. They don't want to follow like 2 hours classes. And that's a shame.
To the point about anti-harassment training, if you look online, if you look on Google, there are tons of harassment training courses out there. It is the norm in any corporate environment. So who are these members of the European Parliament who find this unacceptable?
That's a good question. And this is also the question we ask to all the members of the European Parliament, because we know we have enemies, but we don't know them. They hide themselves. They refuse to discuss with us. They think we are acting against them. We are just asking for clarification and clarity. What I know is that this training, it's only 2 hours. So it's not, we are not talking about 1 day, 1 week training. It's made by amazing trainers who are like therapists at work, specialized in social rights. For the moment, making this training compulsory, it has been done, but for the staff of the European Parliament. So imagine something, James. You have like the training, respect and dignity at work, compulsory for all the staff, at the exception of the members of the European Parliament. We cannot accept that, because we are talking about when you make something compulsory to certain category of people and not to the other one, you insinuate that the person who is victim of sexual harassment, it's her responsibility or his responsibility only. This is what it's absolutely not acceptable. So the one who are blocking, I think the German conservative is a good example. But I would also say the liberals of the European Parliament, and they maybe become like the one of the biggest group for the next mandate. But the excuse is freedom of mandate. They use the freedom of mandate as saying we are not going to go back to schools. We have nothing to learn. And this is not logical at all, because everyone has questions about sexual harassment. And it's not an easy notion. I'm sure, like, if you take a room full of people and if you ask themselves, what's your definition of sexual harassment? Or even better, if you give them a concrete example of what is sexual harassment, I'm sure, like, a lot of the people will say, oh, no, that is not sexual harassment. So this is why this training is important in order to change and to learn, because even MEPs can learn new things.
So there are sort of two theories about why people are resisting. One would be a sort of libertarian mindset, which is, I come here with my own mandate from my electorate. I don't need further education from people in Brussels. The other theory that you were hinting at is the idea that people have stuff to cover up and they don't want a truth commission. And they're afraid of criminal consequences.
Yeah, exactly. And also because one of our main goals as a movement was to put in place an external assessment, like an audit, where this audit can evaluate, give recommendation on how to be more efficient dealing and tackling sexual harassment. And we lost so much time saying, look, we are not organizing a witch hunt. It's not about that. It's just about, like, solving the problem.
So respect and dignity at work. There's already an organization that does that for the European Parliament.
Yeah, exactly.
And they are a Brussels-based training organization?
They are, like, you have, like, many therapists organizing it, but they all come to Brussels, and the training is also available in different languages to make it more accessible to everyone. For the moment, as I was telling you, it's not compulsory for members, so it's on a volunteer basis. And since July 2018, we saw that only 42 MEPs follow this training. And those MEPs that follow the classes are already the one more, like, open-minded and curious.
Right. You're preaching to the converted when it comes to people who voluntarily go to those classes. Now, you spoke as well about the value of this training to change people's perceptions about what harassment actually is. And in some ways, harassment is about things that people haven't really thought of as harassment before. Jokes, comments on bodily appearance, offensive gestures, drawing people into a conversation of a sexual nature. What else am I sort of missing out there?
I think the most important to know about the definition of sexual harassment is the fact that one act can be defined as sexual harassment. So you don't need the repetition or the repetitive act or behaviors. And sexism, like sexist jokes, sexist comments, all that, of course there is confusion in between, is it just like sexist comments or is it sexual harassment? Is it maybe his age? It's a different cultural, like a generational gap. All this is actually really important to define, because sexual harassment is not an easy notion, but what we have to understand is that sexism is a fertile ground for sexual harassment, sexual assault, and even worse, rape.
In terms of training itself, does it work?
To answer your question, what is the utility of this training? First one, the notion of sexual harassment. And the second one is crucial, because politicians are not managers. They were not managers before. They did not know how to manage a team. So they also need to learn on how to solve some issues if they see one issue in between their parliamentary assistant, in between their colleagues. This is also the necessity of following a training, because you will also know where to go in that kind of situation. This is what we say to German politician, conservative. Why are you refusing such a training? You just need, as the employers, to protect your staff.
So the training, the merging of certain committees that deal with complaints, and the external assessment, these three things are part of a pledge that you would like candidates who are standing in the May 2019 European Parliament elections to sign. What is your plan for making sure that the maximum amount of numbers of candidates sign it? You know, what happens if people ignore it?
We will contact every candidate. We will put on our blog, www.metoodep.com, like a new sidebar where you have the pledge and where you have the space for MEP candidates to sign. We will also make sure that those who have been contacted and refused to sign or ignoring us will be also, like, it's going to be also visible on the website.
So there will be a name and shame, as it were, in order to have the deepest conversation possible about what to do with this problem.
I don't know if we can call it like name and shame, but at least everything will be visible. And at the same time, I will have no compassion for people who refuse to sign this pledge. So if they feel ashamed, like, good for them. So they should just change their behavior and sign it.
That's EU Scream for this week. You can check our website at euscream.com for links to topics discussed in the show and for more episodes. Please rate us on iTunes, tweet about us at EU Screams, and like us on Facebook. EU Scream is edited and mixed by me, James Cantor. Tom Brooks and I produce the show. Laura Natale plays our piano. Thanks for listening.